We're in the College of Architecture at Arizona State University in Tempe, and it's 27th of June, and we have now had 2 weeks of temperatures over 110 degrees. And Paolo Soleri, I want to know why you live here.
Oh, I'm one of the lunatics living in Arizona.
Well, lunatic implies you're in love with the moon, not the sun.
I'm stuck.
Well, it seems like it's an important part of your idea of how man ought to live in this earth, that he ought to live sympathetic with nature. And it seems increasingly that Phoenix in the middle of the summer is not just the place to do it.
Well, you can do it if you do it in the right way. And this room, it's one way of doing it. I don't know if it's going to be proved as the right way, this building.
I would agree, but I wonder whether you could point to any examples here in Phoenix that you would find appropriate that are presently existing.
Probably not.
Do you think that there is that possibility?
It better be.
Well, for instance, one solution could be that we could live here for the 8 months that it's really beautiful and move to the beach.
That implies a degree of affluence, which my put a question mark on our realism.
And yet the economic factor may be more modest to move the population than to keep it here.
Under the present conditions, that might be right. Under ideal conditions, that might not be right.
Thank goodness you can erase the blanks. How do you respond to the concepts of mobility which have been advocated by certain recent thinkers and groups who are quite influential in terms of architectural and urban ideas?
Well, I don't know. If we are talking about unlimited mobility, or if we are talking about migrations, the order you were suggesting, that you are in a certain climate and you try to avoid the peaks, the bad peaks in the climate by migrating. So this would be a cyclical migration. And then maybe if we organize society on those terms, that might be making sense, even if we extend this process to the whole of mankind. The whole of mankind migrating unruly, I don't think it's something that we might want to get into. We are not ready for that anyhow. It would be tremendously cost-wise would be a bankruptcy, I think.
To be more specific, your own proposals to date have tended to be rather hard environments in the sense that they're fixed, and they tend to suggest a rather permanent and stable focus for settlement. Have you abandoned or have you ever considered the ideas of a more flexible and diaphanous, let's say, kind of settlement enclosure, let's say, throwaway architecture or movable?
I don't know, diaphanous, that thing might be, it seems to me, it tends to pile up gigantic waste heaps in all corners of the universe. So the diaphany, it might be more illusory than real. If we move from the possibility of having people moving with a little bag or a little suitcase to people moving with their own houses, we can see immediately the amount of materials, hardware, energy that are needed for this process. So I think in a way it was more progressive when people would be moving with their own suitcases to the vacation houses in the countryside than now having a house and buying a mobile home and moving your home with yourself. I think this is a very good indication of what opulence is.
And yet we have seen some demonstrations in the use of pneumatic buildings where indeed one could get a building inside a suitcase. Are those areas that you've thought about?
Yeah, there again, I think we are talking about more of an abstraction and a reality, because evidently you can put your house, this skin, into your suitcase, but you cannot put the services for this skin. So to have something that shelters you from the rain or the wind, it's one thing. To have something that serves you on your daily activities is something else, and you cannot put that in a suitcase.
You've really identified there one of the key architectural and urban problems. A single person by himself will seldom foul his own nest, but when we have conurbations of a million people, we seem to be wallowing in our own excretions. How do you feel that your approach is different from anybody else's in terms of handling this problem of service?
I don't think the problem, maybe the problem is not put rightly, because if there is something which is very clearly indicated by experience, is that that you can obtain efficiency when you're able to have a multiplicity of things going on together. So the more you isolate any kind of system, the more you tend to make this system wasteful.
So you're suggesting that the critical factor is the integration of these various systems of service.
Absolutely. Integration comes from integrity, and integrity is the ability to take the many digits or the many aspects of a very sizable question or problem and see how they can interact in the best way possible at a certain historical moment. And if you go the other way, which is the isolation of the individual, evidently somewhere you're breaking down the integrity of the system.
Earlier in your career, you used a term, biotechnic, which was a way perhaps of expressing a sympathetic relationship of biological needs with technical means. I notice you don't use that term anymore, but it seems as though the idea is still very prominent in your attitude.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you talked about my career. Well, I know I had one.
Why have you dropped the word? Why don't you use that terminology, the bio?
I'm not using the word. I'm using very much the concept, because when I'm suggesting that technology comes before science or comes before anything else, I'm saying that the instrumentalities that which are fostering lives are in a way preceding even life itself. So the biotechnology, it's a technology that comes before man invented the machine or the tool. In other words, all of the evolutionary process that came before man was a biotechnological process. All the process that came after the man appeared on Earth was a process which involved biotechnology and the technological hardware as we know it now. And the more we can integrate the biological aspects, which includes the psychological aspects, with the hardware technology, the more we are able to stay away from the biggest mistakes.
Just following that line of thought, I think some people may assume that in your case, by advocating the plumbing first, that you are perhaps bringing up man after. I suppose that in the integration of these problems, it's difficult to put one thing first. But in fact, are you not a very strong advocate of identifying the technical framework first and then attempting to bring in man as an interacting agent?
Yeah, if by technical we understand what we are, what we mean. The technical medias, you can say, are the original particles. How many are there and what kind they are, everybody knows better than I do. So those were the building blocks that we were presented with from the beginning.
What would you use as
subatomic,
an example?
Subatomic particles and particles that are making for the atomic and then the molecular and so on. So if those are the technical means, definitely I put those ahead over mental process that will organize those elements. But naturally, that goes against the religious idea that God is first, and then from God comes everything else. I say God is last, and we move toward God by the manipulation of those particles.
And this philosophically is how you identify with the Teilhard de Chardin concept of omega.
No, because he's a Catholic, and he definitely states that his conceptual work does not infringe in the beliefs of the Catholic Church in the existence of God.
So you're saying that one of the differences is that he believes that God is pre-existent,
mm-hmm.
whereas in your case you see that as an ultimate goal.
Yeah.
To return to this idea of the relationship of technical means to biological needs, it could almost be suggested that you're putting yourself in a godlike role in the kind of approach that you're advocating.
Yeah, any particle that has achieved some kind of consciousness is a God maker. So it's not that I'm the God maker and you are not. You are, and the worm is, and the tree is, and so on. There are degrees by which you make God.
So each of us shares some fragmentary potential in God-like directions.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this as part of the vectoral system of humanity.
Of life in general, yeah.
Where did you first become conscious of Teilhard de Chardin in his ideas?
When I read somewhere that he died, and I didn't know he existed. And when we were told that he died, we were told that he was a great thinker, and there were some articles written on him.
So it was his obituary that mm-hmm. gave you the first attention, which was in the
I think I got it from 60s. Time magazine. Bless them.
And then you began to read. You did read some of his original work.
Yeah, I got all everything I could get in the French version. Yes,
which was in the original.
French, yeah.
you were surprised, I dare say, at the congruence between some of your ideas.
I was elated.
Elated. still, you personally have not associated with any of the Chardin groups which have formed throughout the world.
I got news for you.
You have?
Yes. They asked me to be a... what is it?
Saint?
No, not a trustee. a consultant, they're part of the organization.
Oh, which... which
this is the one in New York, the Teilhard, the Chardin, what is it, Foundation, or... I think it's the only one existing.
Well, there do seem to be colonies and groups scattered throughout the country and elsewhere. I'm not sure that they're all directly associated with each other. What do you think your contribution might be?
Well, I sent them a number of papers about theology because I told them that maybe they changed their mind when they read those things. They didn't. They still like to get me as a consultant.
Your interest in theology is relatively recent. As a boy or as a young man, you managed fairly successfully to avoid the established church?
No, until about 18 or so, I used to go to church every Sunday.
Were you a choir boy?
In elementary school.
And what happened at the age of 18?
Oh no, long before that I was going to church because I enjoyed the experience.
And the experience was both aesthetic and ritualistic.
And social.
And social,
yeah.
As well as, was there any theological component?
Oh, there was some kind of emotional, I guess, aspects. In a sense that it was pleasant to get into this building or when any one of the buildings, that any one of the churches, and spend half an hour there.
And then what came about around the age of 18?
Well, as I was saying, by then I couldn't really see myself as a devout Catholic. I mean, I was out of the church much.
But you were not willing to take those parts that you could still take. You left everything.
Yeah, but there was no traumatic
moment.
No.
What has brought you back into a stream of appreciation of the theological problem?
Well, at a certain point, you are presented with the question of what do you make of the ecological evolution, for instance? What is it? Well, after turning that thing over and over, you end up by seeing that the ecological evolution is a theological evolution. It's a process of making the physical into the metaphysical.
How long ago did this sort of reveal itself to you?
Well, again, it wasn't a revelation. It was a slow, you know, putting a little thing there, and then more or less suddenly deciding that that's the time where you have to do something about it.
But it's happened, what? Only within the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah. Oh, no, much later. The triggering thing was when suddenly I felt that I could take the word simulation and what it implies, and somehow finding out that religion is simulation. Religion as an established set of revelations or rules or dogmas and so on. And it sounds very blasphemous. It sounds very, you know, nasty, but it's not intended at all that way.
How do you define your use of the word simulation?
The attempt to make something real before this reality has happened.
To anticipate.
To anticipate, yeah.
Whether that's an art or science, in any case, it's anticipatory.
Yeah, it's a very peculiar capacity, ability of mankind.
As distinguished from the other animals.
Yeah. So it's very natural that religion came with mankind, because if it didn't come, something would have been missing in the mind and in the structure of mankind. It had to come, because man had to decide sooner or later what the meaning of himself was and what the meaning of life was. So the best thing he could do was to come into this process of anticipation.
This may be very personal, but how do you feel in your own life, in particular, that you are practicing this anticipatory idea?
Well, we are all practicing this anticipatory idea. At least in our best moments, we say that we are not as good as we should be. So we make another little effort to become slightly better. And this effort puts in another little particle of divinity into the process of the real.
It seems to me that from one point of view, that approach may encourage a certain fantasizing, which separates us from reality. Is that
definitely?
So, in effect, you're fantasizing.
No, I don't. Well, yes, I'm fantasizing. Everybody does.
Regularly.
Hopefully. Yeah, you get up in the morning and you decide, now I'm going to fantasize for 2 hours. No, you're not fantasizing in the sense that you state very clearly that unless you do it, there's nothing else that is going to do it. Because God doesn't exist. I am responsible for the making of God. So if I keep repeating that to myself, evidently, I just waste my time and your time and everybody's time. If I attempt somehow to understand what that might imply within my capacities, then I might attempt to do a little effort, to do something in order to get this thing going, if it was even for an instant. So I would say that fantasizing is when you say, I'm good, I'm bad, I do this and do that, but no matter what happens, God is there and is going to take care of me and my children and my brothers and so on. But if I tell myself that there is not such a thing that can take care of anything, but I am the responsible for the care of everything, then I better get down to something of substance.
To relate that approach to what your experience was early in life, do you practice any outward ritual, or is this mostly a mental and spiritual process?
I have rituals, but they are very, very down-to-earth rituals. I have routines.
You have routines, but they're not religious rituals. I mean, when you water the olive tree, that's a daily. What I wonder is, to what extent is that a direct religious experience for you?
Well, anything that you do, being part of this attempt to build the sacred. It's part of the experience. But naturally, this is almost automatic in any one of us. So it's not that every time you start doing something, you say, now I'm going to do another divine act. You're just very humbly carrying on your business of living. And if the whole thing comes to be together into the art of living, then you got something going.
So you see construction really as a potential sacred ritual.
Like anything else. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, there must be some activities which couldn't be considered as having sacred potential.
Yeah, those have to be. The discrimination has to come from your inside.
I mean, I think it would be difficult, for instance, to identify some of Adolf Hitler's activities with the sense that we're talking now.
Yeah. Though at the same time, you could say with a certain certainty that the phenomenon of the 40s, with all its ugliness, was already something far higher in the making of something metaphysical than the phenomenon of 40 million of years before.
So you're suggesting that even in its blackest moments, things were at a higher level than once?
Mm-hmm. If nothing else, because those blackest moments are triggering things which are incredibly for which you have to have a great reverence. Things happen during those years that they were of a great asset for mankind.
One of the phenomena of religious people, at least in the Western world, seems to be their attempt to become evangelical about their experience and to become missionaries of the faith. How have you become a missionary of your faith?
That's a very tricky affair. If we believe that we really stand for some kind of reverential condition, some kind of sacred phenomenon, then we cannot give up proselytizing. We have to extend this phenomenon as much as we can. So one of the tasks of life is to make more life. And make more life which is more sensitive to what surrounds it. So in a way, if you don't proselytize, you are not doing what you are supposed to be doing. At the same time, as you were saying, proselytizing very often becomes a distortion of not just about anything good or just or compassionate. So there is a great amount of danger in becoming an evangelist.
You're conscious of that danger.
Yes, sir.
And I suppose, how would you identify the way in which you are extending your beliefs? How do you feel you're being most effective?
Yeah. Well, I'm just beginning now. For instance, the papers have not been published.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still writing other papers.
You feel it's going to be primarily through writing?
Well, I can write better than I can speak, I'm sure, though not everybody thinks the same way, but...
But you, I mean, you have made no attempts to
build a pulpit,
right, or to preach, or to insist that your apprentices should follow in your footsteps.
Not yet.
That's coming?
I don't know. We'll see.
Okay. Something to look forward to.
Following in your footsteps, it might not be the best way of putting it, because I might be a devil. You know, I might say, do this, but don't do what I do, as most of us do. Mm-hmm. But I might try to present a certain line of thought, and then say, if you feel that there's something to it, see what you can do about it.
But certainly the direction that you've taken does not lend itself to the sort of religious organization that most of us are familiar with, stylized ritual encapsulation in fairly rigid forms.
Well, one reason is because what I'm advocating is the reversal of the religious frame of reference, by saying that you're not working according to a certain demands put up by your father, your divine father, by saying that we are the maker of a sun god. Evidently, you're turning over the whole theological way of thinking.
So therefore, we shouldn't expect conventional theological expressions?
Not necessarily, because this doesn't mean that you are rejecting all forms of Orthodox religions or any form of existing religions. What you are suggesting is that we have to be careful when we state I'm a Catholic, or I'm a Protestant, or am I a Buddhist, and so on, that by saying this we are also clear in the understanding that ideally, we are seeking something, and we are seeking something that we are the maker of. So we are responsible for this future Catholic God. We are not responsible to the Father God that the Church tells me exists there waiting for me. We're responsible for the making of a Son God, of which I am the Father, and you are the Father.
So when you use the word Son God, you spell it S-O-N.
Well, then we can go into the...
Well, that's into that is a play on words,
yeah,
because
you
have also tended to focus on the sun as a kind of symbol.
That's the Father God, the sun.
Old soul.
The sunshine.
Yes.
And as a Father God, it's a very, you know, it's a furnace.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be careful when you look at a furnace and saying, well, this is a God. And this sun father, this furnace, in the process of time has allowed consciousness to develop, and this consciousness is the maker of the sun, the progeny.
By identifying the sun, you identify very clearly that human life is terminal, that it will have an end to the same extent that the sun is going to burn out.
But again, it's you can just hypothesize, but if the transformation that we have been witnessing of mass energy into something more subtle can be made universal, let's say, then it's not necessarily true that with the end of the physical universe or the end of a solar system, consciousness ends. In fact, this idea of complexity miniaturization, which was the one that really pushed me into the theological problem, would tend to say, if you push it to the limit, then the moment comes when everything is contained in nothing. The utter miniaturization of everything. And at that point, you realize the Omega God. So that means the reversal again of the idea of the Big Bang, where you have a one big atom, and from this big atom you get the universe. It's the opposite. From the universe you get a big atom, which possibly it's a divinity, all conscious, all powerful, all encompassing, and so on.
On that end of it, when you use the term sun, S-O-N, as the ultimate progeny, it is that final unity that approaches nothing.
Well, nothing in size, everything in consciousness. Yeah. So it's the media has become the message. You begin with the media, with no message. And you can say that this media is made of almost an infinite number of little gods, all the particles, the physical particles, totally segregated, connected only by few physical forces, or whatever you want to call them. And then slowly from this total scattering, this polytheism, which is a total polytheism, you build more and more centered gods or sub-gods, with the tendency of coming out with the monotheistic final expression, which is the omega point. So that again, it's a reversal of the process that we tend to attribute to God. At the beginning was the logos, was the word. Well, at the end is the word, from my point of view. At the beginning, it's the universe of mass energy with its own statistical laws.
How do theologians react to having an architect messing in their field?
I don't know. I didn't ask them.
How do these thoughts relate to architecture?
Well, as I was saying, part of this process came out because I had to see what the logical consequence of complexity and miniaturization would bring in. So in this process of going from total polytheism to monotheism, you stumble on the city, in the city. And you have to stumble in the city because the city is it's a larger, in a way, a larger reality of the single dwelling. And it's more central to this gathering and to this disaggregation, to this integration of things. In that sense, I tend to, you know, to introduce the idea of the Civitate Dei, that the city of God, because you are really dealing with one of the most powerful instruments we have toward divinity. And the misuse of it, it's a crime.
You see the city as the ultimate artifact of humanity.
Not ultimate, but it definitely one of the most desirable and the most profitable instruments for the making of God.
You mentioned the term Civitas Dei. This suggests a rather strong association with certain medieval thought. As a boy, I assume that you studied.
Well, I didn't study, I read, but unfortunately I seem to be forgetting what I read.
Well,
immediately after I read it.
Yes.
So I don't know.
Presumably it's in there somewhere.
Probably.
Can you remember who you read?
Well, I read some Saint Augustine. I read some of the Greek thinkers, some of the German thinkers, some of the most contemporary French thinkers. But I'm not a scholar by far. I mean, I wish I were.
Did you ever read Thomas More's Utopia?
No. I only got into the English language.
By default?
By default. And I'm still trying to get it. I'm not trying too hard, though.
So, you see your particular involvement in the city as part of this, if you like, divine responsibility of man.
Yeah, I felt much more sure in my drive, in what I call the ecology, because you need some kind of a name. When I was able to tie this within a larger frame of reference, which I tend to call a theological reference, frame of reference.
The term arcology is probably, of all of the words that you've invented, the one that may stick. Can you explain what it means and how you got there?
Well, I've always been a little put off or put out by the profession.
You mean the architectural profession?
The profession. Because I felt that, there again, you need to have a frame of reference which is as some substance in order to be able to act. And the frame of reference of architecture is the environment, evidently. And the physical environment, specifically, not only the physical, but evidently the physical environment, it's basic to the profession of architecture. So what to do to express, maybe in polemic terms or in strong terms, this thing in one word? Well, you say architecture is an ecological process. Naturally, and then you have to specify that the ecology doesn't belong just to the lizard or to the forest. Ecology is the reality in a certain corner of the universe, and this reality includes all the existing creatures in this corner of the universe. So ecology includes man, includes the mind of man, includes the drives of man, and so on. So architecture and ecology.
You're implying that this relationship doesn't have to necessarily take place on a vast, gigantic scale. It can exist in a very modest and intimate kind of situation.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the tenets or the methodology is the rejection of the gigantic. The gigantic is the pathological.
It seems as though that the word arcology has tended to be associated with some of the gigantic proposals that you have made, missing this kind of meaning.
Mm-hmm. Well, if the person that lives in a certain contest, let's say Phoenix, doesn't realize that this contest is gigantic, then this person has to do some homework. It's gigantic because it doesn't relate to what we call the human scale. It relates so little with the human scale that Phoenix practically, it's a sequence of isolation booths that you are trying to bridge between each other as quickly as you can in order to not to be fried on the pavement or something like that.
But in effect, the term arcology could apply to a very modest one-family house, which was in a sympathetic relationship to its surrounding.
Yeah, but we are on this planet with its own limitations, and we multiply ourselves. So when you introduce the element of number in it.